Well, thank you very much for that introduction, Liz. So great to be here and sharing some knowledge with you all about women in the history of cartography. So as Liz said, my name is Jack Swab. I am a PhD student at the University of Kentucky in the Department of Geography. And today I'll be talking to you about some work that I did during my master's project on the Sanborn Map Company. So the title of my project is Beyond Clerical Cartography, Gender and the Production of Sanborn Fire Insurance Maps in the 1920s. And so before I get into talking about the role of gender at the company, I wanted to explain a little bit about what Sanborn maps are for those of you who may not be aware. So there's an example of a Sanborn map here. A Sanborn map is a type of map designed specifically for use in the fire insurance industry. And the whole point is that it allows underwriters to remotely assess risk. So instead of sending out an agent to look at a prospective building that they wanted to insure, they could stay in the comfort of their own offices and look at these maps. And so these sorts of maps not only depict kind of general information about the street grid and the buildings that exists in any given town, but they also look at the various things that would influence the ability for a building to burn. So they will highlight industries that might use a lot of heat or might be working with flammable chemicals. They show all the different building materials. So here, the pink color refers to buildings that are made out of brick and thus are more fire resistant. So these maps are kind of chock full of information about the built environment of the United States. And so what makes the Sanborn Map Company so prominent in the history of American cartography is really its largesse, its huge size. So Sanborn mapped about 12,000 places from the during the years that it was active in producing these fire insurance maps. So roughly about 100 years from the late 1860s to the early 1970s, they mapped over 12,000 towns and cities. At their height during the 1920s, they had about 1,000 employees, and they produced over 1 million unique sheets. So this is not their total output. They produce many, many millions more, but purely in terms of sheets that are unique and ready to be copyrighted, there are roughly about 1 million of those. That exist. So of the roughly 1,000 employees that Sanborn had during the 1920s, I estimate that roughly about one third of these 1,000 employees were women. And so having 1,000 employees places Sanborn as one of the largest companies or one of the largest assemblages of cartographers in the United States during the 20th century. And with 300 women on payroll, makes them probably one of the largest employers of women cartographers as well. And so as Judith Tyner has written recently about the role of women in the history of cartography, there's been little on the day-to-day work of making maps, and there's been little about the role of individuals who work for government agencies, commercial companies, societies, and institutions. And so what my work here is trying to do is specifically kind of plug two of these or add a little bit of knowledge to plug some of these holes of talking a little bit of what it was like to work for the company in the day-to-day and specifically around a company that was making maps to turn a profit. This work also is grounded in Matthew Edney's idea of the precessual turn that he has recently articulated in Cartography, the Ideal and Its History. So traditionally, modes of, history of cartography have kind of reified the sole cartographer, what I like to call the capital C cartographer, typically a man. Typically, somebody who went out into the field and was the first to map something, or was the first to use this method, or created a very dynamic series of maps, or who knows what. And typically, this work reifies one individual and says, oh, look at how great they are. And sometimes it talks about the support staff, not quite as often. or that support staff is not mentioned at all. And so this is everyone else who helps with the production of the map, whether that be the printers, whether that be the people who help finance it, whether that be the individuals who help outfit the cartographers so that they can go out into the field. And so in the what the processual turn asks us to do is to kind of get rid of this idea of a sole capital C cartographer to what I like to call lowercase c cartographer, where a cartographer is equal to anyone who touches the map, anyone who somehow influences the creation and the development of it has a claim to call themselves cartographer. And so this is really quite important when we are talking about the role of women in the history of cartography, because oftentimes women were not the ones who were going out into the field collecting data or drawing up the maps out in the field. They were doing more what we would probably see as clerical tasks. But as I am going to show, these clerical tasks are very much essential to the undergirding of the entire operation of taking a map from a draft on a piece of paper to actually being able to publish it and sell it and make money, or at least in the case of Sandborn Maps. And I believe that this is this goes for other companies as well. So unfortunately, I don't have a ton of time to hop into what the steps of the creation of a Sandborn map are into too much detail, but I will kind of roughly go through the process. As you can see here, any box that is outlined in red indicates that there were paid women workers who worked in these various departments at Sanborn. I would like to say, and I very much have examples of unpaid emotional labor that women had to do for in these other departments, the ones that don't have paid women workers, but kind of speaking strictly in the sense of people who were on the payroll, women were most prominent in these departments that are highlighted in red. So when a Sandborn map was commissioned to be made, in the first step, a surveyor would go out to the field, create a draft map, and then send a draft map back to one of Sanborn's three factories. So they had a factory outside of New York City, they had one in Chicago and one in San Francisco, and women worked at all of those plants. It would go through through the examining and proofing departments, both of which had women working for them. In these departments, employees would make sure that basically the surveyor had actually surveyed everything that needed to be surveyed, they hadn't left anything out by accident, and that, you know, street names were correct and things like that. Here they would corroborate with other data sources. Then it would get sent to the drafting and composing department, where the draft maps made by the surveyor would be redrawn so that they would take up the least number of pages. Then after the composing department, they would go down to be printed, be lithographed and printed. And then after each individual sheet was printed, they would be sent to the coloring department. The coloring department was one of the largest at Sanborn and employed the most number of women. And the coloring department was so large because Sanborn colored everything by hand. They found it cheaper to employ individuals to color things by hand than it was to use lithography. And so after this, there are kind of like one of two ways a map would go. If it was a new map that was just being published, it would get bound and then shipped out to insurance agents. If these were corrections to go onto an already existing map as a way to kind of save money, they would go to the cutting department where women would individually cut out each correction and assemble them to be shipped off. And then they would be shipped to women who worked out in major American cities whose sole job was to go to individual insurance agents and paste in these corrections. And so as hopefully as you can gather from this process, women are an integral part of this work. While their work in some ways was, you could think of it as like a Fordist assembly line, you know, they might just be coloring all day long or cutting various corrections out all day long. What they were doing is fundamental to this process. So I'm pulling most of the information, some of the couple case studies that I'm going to go through here pretty quickly in the next couple minutes from an internal newsletter called the Sanborn Survey. This newsletter was not just a way for the company to spread out information about its policies, but it was also a way to create a community out of a geographically dispersed workforce. So with so many employees all over the United States, whether they were Sanborn surveyors on the move, pasters who were going from insurance company to insurance company, or people at the different plants, they needed a way to create community. And so these surveys are not just corporate policies, but they're also updates about so-and-so got married and so-and-so, you know, is out sick and, you know, here's a fun trip that I went on and things like that. So I'm going to look quickly at some employee examples, some the role of sexism in the workplace and some corporate policies that Sanborn had that made this a unique working experience for women. So my first example of a female employee at Sanborn is actually the longest serving Sanborn employee by the name of Laura Sturdivant. Laura was hired by the founder of the company, Daniel Sanborn, in 1867 at the age of 26. She was hired to color maps and trace them. Quite good at the job. So much so that she was promoted over the years to actually become a manager and forum woman of the coloring force at the New York factory. So these various census recordings of her occupation show kind of the surprise perhaps at the census taker of a woman manager of trying to figure out what her job occupation or what to call her job. She did retire in 1918, which is before the 1920s, but she was able to, she often wrote in to the Sanborn survey about her time at working as an employee with Sanborn and shared some stories that, while she didn't call them sexist, are quite apparent today to be issues related to sexism. So for example, when she was first hired, there were men and women working as map colorers. The men all took smoke breaks. So Laura was one of the more efficient of the map colorers, and Daniel Sanborn, the company founder, asked her to keep track of how long it took on average to complete each sheet every day. So he, at the end of the week, he tallied all that up, and her average became the new time limit for an individual to spend on creating a sheet. And this made the men very angry because now they could no longer take their smoke breaks. And it actually ended up forcing the men to leave the company because they didn't like it. And it forced more women to work to step into these roles because they were more efficient. Similarly, there were times where the company didn't quite have as much work, so they would move employees around to kind of use labor the most efficiently. And so Laura had real issues dealing and managing men because the women were paid piecemeal for their work and could actually make more than some of the lower paid men who were just paid straight wages. And so the men would refuse to do more work than they thought was reasonable because they weren't being paid as much as the women were. So those are just two kind of interesting examples of sexism in the workplace. Other sexism came out in the Sanborn survey about current employees. So as I mentioned, there was plenty of talk about personal updates, you know, children being born, marriages, deaths, things like that. So this one personal starts out fairly innocently talking about someone, about two coworkers who had gotten married, and then ends with this very disgusting, misogynistic, just frankly gross discussion of, you know, the other female employees that are still in the office that are unmarried that a male Sanborn employee should come and see if he wants to date and marry one of them. And so this is kind of rampant across these documents. But intermarriage within Sanborn was actually quite common because there were just so many young women and men working in these roles. And it led to what we would today call flex work opportunities, so flexible working opportunities. And the flex work was really designed as a way to essentially allow women to continue to work while balancing their traditional gender roles. So women would be working full time, they would get engaged to somebody in the company, they would get married, they would be expected to, set up home and do all sorts of other, the gender dynamics of becoming a wife. And then after a year or so, they could come back full time if they, felt like they were ready to. There are also other examples of women who would come back during the school year when their children were at work. So there were ways that even though they were reinforcing these sexist norms, women were still allowed to work and get out of the house and do other sorts of work. The company also started to implement benefits during the 1920s, including an employee stockholder plan and life insurance. And so these provided additional benefits for women workers who had worked for the company for a decent amount of time. And so this allowed them to have some measure of financial security that they might not otherwise have. And so, similar to today, however, it disadvantages the individuals who haven't quite been with the company as long, which oftentimes is women and other minority workers. So it's not flawless, but it was some sort of work during the 1920s. So to wrap up, I want to just show this little screen grab from one of the newsletters that says, "Is Sanborn surveying one of these? Out of the 670 possible occupations listed by the Census Bureau, only 33 have not yet been invaded by women." Of course, Sanborn surveying was one of these. Sanborn surveying, there was never a woman surveyor, as far as I can tell, but women were so fundamental to this process. They were the ones who undergirded it and who helped maintain these maps and make the company efficient. And so telling the story of them is telling the story of the Sanborn Company as well. So with that, I'd like to thank you very much for tuning in and listening to me, and open it up to any questions. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed, Jack. I really enjoyed that very much indeed. We've got time, I think, just for a brief set of questions. So I'd like to just probe a little bit some of the attitudes to women. Obviously, lots of contradictions. The caption beneath your image showed the Sanborn girls. So obviously a sort of, the use of the diminutive, the young there, despite the fact that, as you say, some of them were older, married women. And the sort of interesting dynamic that you said that it was cheaper to employ women than to upgrade to the more modern, expensive technology of color lithography, which is always held to be, a big breakthrough in cartographic circles, but we have the deliberate decision not to use this expensive technology when you can get cheap female labor. But on the other hand, the women are setting the pace with production and being paid. So there's lots of different kind of contradictory things going on there. I wonder if you could probe them a bit more.
Yeah, these contradictions are really actually quite fascinating. And they add such an additional dimension to the study of these maps, because so oftentimes they're just kind of used to glean information about historical built environments. And so I think what is kind of the best way to approach this and to think about this is about like the tenure that many employees had with the company. So when they implemented, for example, the life insurance policy, you basically, the longer you were employed, the more payout that you got if you were to die unexpectedly. And in terms of workers who would get their full payout based upon how long they were working, I think as soon as that policy went into effect, something like 70% of the workforce was eligible for their full salary. And so it really speaks to the ways in which, even though women's labor was often devalued in such ways, there were women who felt like that this was a good job, that this was something outside of kind of the traditional gender roles of the 1920s in terms of jobs that typically had women either as, you know, stenographers or teachers or, you know, like bank tellers, things like that. It was a different type of work. And it's also clear too from these articles that because there were so many women who worked for the company, there was a certain sense of camaraderie that different departments would, you know, at lunchtime, they would all kind of like get together and, you know, like have book clubs, or they would have field day during the summer and things like that. So there was definitely a social element too that I think probably kept women, well, kept women more employed there, because there was a network, much in the way that, you know, anybody who feels kind of more appreciated at their job and has fun going to it probably doesn't want to leave.
Thank you. We have just had another question come through, so I'll just ask you that if I may really quickly, which is about, you mentioned collective social life, about collective union activity, whether the workforce was unionized, and if so, was there a male-female difference in that?
So as far as I can tell, they were not unionized. I have not seen anything that seems to indicate that there was like a potential for them to become unionized, and, you know, it got shut down or whatnot. The actual composition of the survey itself, I'm not sure how much editorial control was held by the company. So, you know, if there were attempts to unionize, you know, they may have been completely cut out, you know, to keep labor, you know, cheaper and whatnot. But as far as I can tell, there was not a kind of like a union dimension that could have worked to improve those sorts of conditions.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I really very much enjoyed that. That was just fascinating. Thank you.